When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Guys, welcome back to another episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. He's back. We've got Mark Greene, the famous New York Times bestselling author. We had him on last year, right around the same time, for Burner, which exceeded expectations, which is not surprising.
Yeah, no, it did great. Yeah.
Have you seen an increase in sales because of the Gray Man series on Netflix?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe not as much as people would expect. I mean, it didn't like double or anything like that. But I mean, it's a healthy benefit. It was the film was seen, I think, 258 million hours in the first 28 days or something. And so that obviously translated to book sales. And, you know, it sells previous titles, too. And I have another series and it sells those books. And so, you know, it's good all around when it happens. You're very fortunate.
You know, and your books stand on merit alone, but it's always like, it's always a movie that gets them over the top. It just,
from the very beginning, people have been, you know, coming up to me as like, when they're gonna make a movie, when they're gonna make, and I sold, I had the film the book optioned to Hollywood very, very early. So I could always go like, well, you know, they're working on it, but I never really thought anything was going to happen. At one point, like 10 years ago, Brad Pitt was signed up to do it, and it looked really good, and then that died on the vine, and you know, and other points it got kind of close, and so I just never believed it was going to happen.
You know, I'm trying to think of Brad Pitt in that role. I think you lucked out with Ryan Gosling.
No, I think I did. Yeah, I did too.
His swagger, which played to the character of Court Gentry.
Yeah, very well. Yeah, he doesn't play it like overly, you know, like tough guy stuff or whatever, which is what I like. You know, that's the way I write the character.
The Burner was last year. Mm-hmm. Chaos Agent just came out 1 month ago.
Yeah.
How's it doing?
Exceeding? It's doing really well. We hit number 5 on the New York Times list in the combined ebook and print, and number 9 in audiobook. And everybody's happy with it. The reviews overall have been really good. So I'm happy.
So how many times on the New York Times bestselling list is that for you?
For me? I think 16 or 17. I'd have to think about it. I can think of the ones that didn't hit.
I love that you don't know that. Well, I love that you're like, oh, hey, awesome, cool. I'm getting back to writing.
I know all the ones that didn't hit, so I just would have to add them up.
This is, how many novels in the series total?
So this is the 13th book in the series, in the Gray Man series, yeah.
So you've hit pretty much every year since 2018 you've had a release.
Yeah, that sounds about right. My 6th book was called Gunmetal Gray, and that was the first one to hit the list, and I've hit the list with every book since then, and then I've had a couple other series, or books out of a couple other series, and they've hit the list, and then, of course, all the books that have my name in small print and Tom Clancy's name in massive print, they all did quite well, so there was always an asterisk by my name as far as I was concerned.
Because there was a 3-year gap, if I'm not incorrect, in the Gray Man series, because you had gone to concentrate on the Tom Clancy
stuff. Yeah, and I ultimately wrote a Clancy book and a Gray Man book every year, but there was a break right around the time that he passed away where they said, hey, we want to do 2 books next year and we're going to need you to write, you know, we want you to write them both. So I took that year off and then wrote the book the next year. So it ended up being like right out of 3-year gap in Gray Man books.
Ah, worth it. Worth it.
Yeah.
So I see you've been traveling quite a bit.
Yeah, I've been, I just got off of a book tour, which was a lot of fun, and took a vacation with my wife because we've been married 3 years and we haven't really gone anywhere. No, it's not true. One other time we went someplace that had nothing to do with book research, but it was Florida. book research or a book event or else family trips. We've gone on some things that are just purely family trips. So I just saw that I was going to have a little gap of time before I had to get into the 14th Gray Man book. So we went to Paris last week and had a really good time. But previous to that, I was in West Africa doing research on a book that I have coming out in June. And this year I'm going to Central Europe and I'm going, to the United Arab Emirates and do some other stuff.
Yeah, well, Central Europe sounds a lot better than West Africa.
Yeah.
It's not exactly. Do you travel by yourself on that one?
I traveled by myself. And it was a really actually nice trip. I liked it. It was, obviously developing world, serious developing world, a lot of poverty. But the people were surprisingly nice. Like I found myself in, I hate to use the word slums. It's probably not politically correct, but I don't know what else to call them. people call slums is where I found I got out of the cab and I thought I was someplace and I was someplace else. And I ended up in there for like a half an hour because I was immediately sort of like bombarded by like eight guys that if they pulled out machetes, they would have hacked me up. And in a movie, they looked like murderers, but they were actually really cool dudes. And then some other guys were trying to like get my attention. They're trying to sell me stuff. And then these guys looked like they were going to fight with them. And you know, it was this whole thing. I was a pawn in the middle of this and it was just open sewers and kids with no clothes on, that whole thing. And I was in there for a half an hour. I was like, I never would have put myself in that situation, but I'm really glad that I experienced.
So you don't travel with security?
No. I've never traveled with security.
Certain places like that, I would travel with security.
Yeah, I've never felt like I've needed it, although I have stupidly gotten myself. I was in a part of Mexico that I thought was, close to trouble, but safe. And so I could say I got close to trouble. And when I was there, I was going like, okay, I'm walking through a civil war and everybody's wondering what I'm doing here. It was in Nayarit, so just south of Sinaloa, but the very northern tip of Nayarit. And then I was in El Salvador and I saw four dead bodies like in 2 days. And I'm like, okay, it's probably a bit off more than I could chew here, but usually everything's fine.
Yeah, El Salvador is a, I feel for those people.
Oh, for sure.
The lawlessness.
Yeah.
But hey, the president's investing in Bitcoin. Good on him.
The president of El Salvador is?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that. It's the most densely populated country in the entire hemisphere.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's like really densely populated and it's incredibly poor. And people drive like maniacs there.
Yeah. I mean, it's no surprise why people in South America, in places like El Salvador, are coming here in groves.
Yeah,
it's the beacon on the hill. Of course, I do the same thing.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, if you had a family and you had an opportunity to go someplace, even if you were going to work the lowest labor job, that there was, which is what a lot of people do. I mean, you would do it for your family.
And no, so it's safe.
I don't like it when Americans get on a high horse about immigrants. I mean, you can definitely say we need to have our borders protected. We absolutely should, and probably 100 times more than they are. But at the same time, the immigrants who come in that are law abiding, God
bless them. It's why my family came over here in 1899.
I'm sure from where?
From Italy.
Okay.
We came to the West Coast, Treasure Island, which was a Navy base at some point, but quarantine, and then we've been in San Francisco ever since.
Wow.
But yeah. I mean, it's a land of immigrants.
Absolutely.
I do agree with you. It just has to be through legal channels and proper means.
Right.
But your heart has to sing out to them.
Yeah.
And then there's also the thing about it, and you probably know this, our workforce numbers are dwindling, especially with, the baby boomers are pretty much going into retirement in groves unless they can't stop working.
Yeah.
People who own businesses don't have succession plans with their kids.
Right.
No one to pass a business to. And China's the same way.
Yeah.
Have you ever traveled to China for research or any of your books?
Yeah, yeah. I've been to Beijing and Hong Kong, and that's all. But it was a fascinating place. I really loved it.
I've never been to China.
Oh, you haven't?
No. Japan, that's the closest I've gotten.
I mean, Hong Kong now is like complete China.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was there, it was quasi-China, and China kind of left it alone a little bit. And so I don't know what it would be like politically to go back. I had a great time in China and Hong Kong. I mean, it's so congested and so smoggy, and it was so hot and humid. I'm like, I live in Memphis, Tennessee, which is hot and humid central, and it was 10 times worse in April in Hong Kong.
Did you post something recently about Memphis and the crime?
Oh, yeah. I posted. So Memphis is terrible crime rate. I think we talked about this last year, I remember. Because I walked out of here last year going like, am I in trouble back in Memphis for what I said? And nobody cares. But yeah, there was a thing on the news that we'd had 20 shootings in a 5-day period, 10 people killed, 20 people injured. So, but, you know, after a week, they'd cleared two of the shootings, two out of 20. And, you know, it's bad. And it's just yesterday in Memphis, somebody, you know, got shot not too far from where I live and survived, or is still alive at this juncture. But, yeah, the crime is just awful.
There's a lot of places like that in the U.S. We just had a police officer from Fort Worth on last week. Mm-hmm. Interesting to hear his perspective. Dying to do their job, just sometimes lack of support from the general populace. But diving into the Chaos Agent, you took on a really relevant topic because people are, some people are gung-ho AI, some people are not.
Yeah.
We're using the hell out of AI.
Sure.
Why wouldn't you? It speeds up business. Mm-hmm. So not to give away, and you can better coming from you, court is... with Zoya, pretty much trying to live on the low in Central America. But they get wrapped up into the plot of AI. Someone's eliminating a majority of the AI scientists in order to, if I'm correct here, sort of get majority control of AI.
Yeah.
And the plot goes from there. What can you give the readers? Because I read the reviews, and man, you've got a cult. Like following, that's got to be fun. And I got to say this, after you came on the podcast last time, I brought my wife to the, I forget what bookstore it was, but you held a sort of a book reading, answered questions, and you had at least 30 people in there, and they were just all waiting for your autograph. I mean, they were actually asking relevant questions. They were asking you a lot of your perspective on current sort of foreign affairs. Yeah. Do you get that a lot?
I get that a lot. And I always, you know, sort of like want to say like, look, I became as much of an expert as I could in 6 months to write the story. But I was just in Alexandria, Virginia, like 2 weeks ago. And Senator Mark Warner, head of the Select Intelligence Committee, Senate Intelligence Committee, he came to the signing. He's a big fan. And he's like, you know, people say that Republicans and Democrats don't agree, but John Cornyn, who's a Texas guy, he's like, he's a big fan. He wanted to be here tonight, but he had some big things going on in his career at the moment. And he said, I'm not going to say that, you know, we make people on our staff read your books, but we highly encourage it, you know, and I was like, that's pretty awesome, you know. And then in the back of my head, I'm like, man, I was a bartender till I was like 30. but I had other jobs, and I've always been, you know, I had a poli sci degree and always been interested in that kind of stuff. But it's cool when people ask my, you know, I'm wrong about stuff sometimes. You know, people like I was at a signing like a week before the Russia invaded, and they're like, is Russia Ukraine or the, you know, the recent phase of their invasion? They're like, are they going to do it? And I was like, I just feel like there's too many negatives for them and enough pluses to do this saber rattling. So I feel like this might be a bluff. And then, you know, they went over the border a few hours later. So that's going to happen. I think a lot of us were wrong.
I think in today's day and age, I said the same thing. I'm like, there's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Yeah.
In trying to avoid politics as much as possible, I mean, how often are you keeping up on foreign affairs and even our sort of defense strategy or intelligence strategy?
I mean, I that's where my brain wants to be. I listen to a podcast every day about the war in Ukraine, and I look at everything that I can. When I'm focused on a book, which is really all the time, the majority of the big reading, the books that I read, are about whatever that subject matter is. But I'm constantly interested in what's going on with China and Russia and, you know, Western Europe, that sort of thing.
We are, you know, you go back to 2001, 9/11. No one could have predicted the predicament we're in now with Israel, Hamas.
Yeah.
You've got Russia, Ukraine. You've got China basically using disintegration warfare. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a few flag officers, general officers who are sort of news pundits, and they said China will take Taiwan without a shot fired. And they're like, they're just going to wear us out from within, which I found interesting. But on the topic of Russia and Ukraine, what are your thoughts on how this ends? And that is such a vague question?
I mean, I think so. I don't think there will ever be a stage where Putin says, I'm going to declare victory without victory and back away. I feel like his psychology is too involved in this. You know, he has to exert power. He doesn't care how many people die. He does could not possibly care less. He will.
But that's sort of Russia. I mean, you look at their style of warfare. Yeah. I mean, wasn't it Stalin who said they have better weapons, but we have more soldiers.
Yeah.
We'll just outlast their bullets.
And that's what you see. And, you know, even though last year, you remember Wagner pulled a bunch of people out of prisons, you know, out of the gulags and said, hey, if you can make it 6 months, you get out of jail free type of thing. And almost none of them made it. But, you know, I've been researching the Russian prison colony system and stuff for my new book. And it's like, oh, there's a limited list supply of bad people. And obviously, there's a lot of good people in Russian prisons as well. But, you know, it's like they could do that and put a couple more million people, into that war. And, you know, they estimate 315,000 Russian deaths so far. And Putin couldn't care less because he's, you know, other than, you know, some piddly drone blowing up above the Kremlin, you know, he's not in any danger whatsoever.
That was a interesting incident with Wagner and the head of Wagner, mm-hmm. Prigozhin, who, you know, left the Ukraine. Drove, what was he, I think like 50 miles from Moscow before
he got a lot of people think he got closer than he was planning on getting. And that maybe he was just trying to make some kind of a statement. And then there was like really nobody stopping him. And he's like, well, wait, what am I doing here? I don't know. That's just like some of the speculation.
When he was shot out of the sky, people were up in arms. And a lot of us just shrugged our shoulders and were like, that's just the Russian way.
Yeah,
like if you're a internal foe, they'll just eliminate you.
Yeah, as soon as that, you know, he went and spoke to Putin after it was over, and it was like, you know, all's going to be forgotten type of thing, and I was going like, no, all's not going to be forgotten. And the same thing with poor Alexei Navalny. Once he made that decision to go back to Russia, I was going like,
you're done. You're
death sentence. Yeah, you're not going to get this uprising. You know, this popular uprising that's going to help you. You're going to go straight to prison. And you're going to die there.
And they'll find a way.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. And you know a lot about the Russian military. I mean, I remember in the Marine Corps, being a recon Marine, all we did was study Russian armor and weapon IDs.
Yeah.
Because through binoculars, you got to be able to identify whatever the vehicle is. Did you think the Russian military was as bad as they've shown during this? I mean, logistically, in their military equipment is just so aged. Did you think they were this bad?
Well, unfortunately, I cannot lie about my answer to that question because I co-authored a book in 2019 called Red Metal with a then active duty Marine Lieutenant Commander and Lieutenant Colonel. And we had the Russians using, it was a Russian war with Europe, and we had the Russians using T-14 Armada tanks or whatever. Have we seen one of those? I don't think we've seen one of those in this, you know, what are there's, you know, T-72s, but T-60s and stuff. They're using like stuff that we couldn't imagine. Their tires are rotten. You know, it's so bad. So no, I didn't predict how bad it would be. In my defense, if I turned in a book to my publisher where the adversary sucks so bad, it never would have gotten published. if you want to see like Russia's imagination of how great their military could be, that's in the book that I wrote. Yeah. But the reality is really sad. They've got these, you know, the first wave was, you know, a couple hundred thousand kids from the Urals who didn't even know they were going to war, or at least, you know, some of them didn't. It's just amazing.
This has been, I don't know how this will end.
Yeah.
I think, albeit the Russian military's performance has been, there's no other way to say it, piss poor.
Yeah.
They win through sheer numbers alone.
Yeah, they've got so much. And obviously, Ukraine needs our support. I mean, I look at it like this. Less than 5% of our annual defense budget was going to completely destabilize our main, you know, strategic foe, and that without costing any American lives. You know, we're just supporting Ukraine, and we are not even able to do that. I mean, Emmanuel Macron in France, who would have thought that he would be the one, you know, picking up the gauntlet and really spearheading where they are now. But right now, Ukraine is it's impossible for them to make any advances. Their artillery is way, way down, and they're being way overmatched by Russia.
Honestly, I think give them the Donbass region and come to some ceasefire terms.
Yeah.
Everyone wants this to be over, but I do think NATO's scare tactics of Putin and Russia pushing further west are they're illogical. I think he's shown that he doesn't have the infrastructure to push further west, and I don't think he wants to.
I agree with you about 85% of the way. You know, I think Lithuania, the Kaliningrad corridor, so Kaliningrad is a part of Russia that's not connected to Russia. I see that very easy for him to take, even even with through Belarus, even with as bad as things are for him. So I do think there would be some gains. I don't think he would be satiated. I think he would be emboldened by this. Again, he's got millions and millions of people. He's got artillery from North Korea. He's getting support from obviously Iran and all these other things. So I could see him, trying to bite off other chunks of the former Soviet Union. I don't think he's going to Russia's not going to invade France or anything like that. But I think he will do whatever he can get away with for as long as he's around. And, God help us for whoever comes next, hopefully he's better.
It's, you got to wonder what his, it would take a very smart person to know the psychology of Putin, but who studied him for life, but I mean, is it he wants a seat at the table? He wants credibility. He just wants to expand Russia. Like, ultimately, what are his, what's his ultimatum here? What's he trying to gain?
There's a bunch going on there. I feel like he sees himself like as one of the old czars or whatever, he's going to restore Russia to its former glory. And he said, the worst thing that's happened in the last century was the Soviet Union's dissolution. At the same time, he is a kleptocrat on a scale that we'd never seen. I mean, he's a criminal boss, and as long as he's in power, he's never going to have to pay the piper for, his
actions.
His billions overseas, or that he's funneled the wealth from the people and given it to themselves. The second that he lost power, the second that he showed weakness and somebody else showed more strength, Prigozhin didn't get close, but he got closer than anybody else, right? With popular support and all that. When I was in Moscow several years ago, I came home telling people, I was like, there were so many different types of camouflage uniforms of jackbooted dudes walking through Moscow with batons and rifles. And I saw a couple, they might have been Armenian or something like that, like dragged away and put in a car, just off the subway. And they had kind of a Hitler youth type of a thing. They had these young, like 14-year-old girls in, fatigue standing on the corners with signs. I don't know what the sign said, because obviously it was in Cyrillic, but, just giving like steely-eyed, statue things. And I was going like, wow, this is kind of a different vibe than I thought. It's like, I thought Russia was our friend now. I mean, I knew that Putin's been bad since 99 when he started blowing up his own people to for his own popularity.
He's ruthless.
Yeah.
Again, I've never been to Russia.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend it now.
Now, yes. I'd probably get wrapped up very quickly for some infraction.
Yeah.
Were the people welcoming? I've heard both sides. People are like, they're just really cold people. And some people have come back and they're like, no, they were very kind and welcoming. And
my exchanges were okay, but it's not a place that I look back on and go, everybody was so, nice to me and they were so happy to see an American. It wasn't like that at all. But it wasn't, it wasn't bad. It wasn't overtly bad. It was just funny. Like, Moscow is kind of a gray brown city, and then you go to St. Petersburg and it's very sparkly, and it's kind of like the cliche of what you would think about Russia. Those are the only two places I went, Moscow and St. Petersburg. And I definitely enjoyed being there. I got followed in Moscow, and it's super overtly, like, it was either this guy's real bad at his job or they just don't care.
They want you to know.
It was like, I saw somebody at GUM, which used to be the big department store, and now it's like a mall, And this young guy was just showing up everywhere. Me and my girlfriend were showing up. And then I went to another place that was probably 25-minute walk away, kind of like a touristy thing or whatever. And same dude is there. And I actually have a picture of him somewhere. I took it when he was walking away. I took a picture of him.
Your reputation precedes you. They probably just wanted to come up and say, make Russia look good.
Yeah, right. They're like, I think we know what you're doing. That's when I was writing a Tom Clancy novel. So that was old, that was old, like 2014. And I haven't been back, and I don't guess I'll ever go back.
You're talking about the next Gray Man coming out on Netflix. No timeline has been established. You may not be able to talk about much, but man, I've been dying for that next one to come out. It seems like it's been forever.
Me too. Yeah. So it came out, over a year and a half ago, and I do know that they have a script. There was also the writer's strike and the actor strike and stuff like that. So I don't know when the release date is of the next one. I know it's still, they still plan on doing it as far as I know. So I'm hopeful that it comes out. They told me what book they were adapting, and I can't really say, but it's another one from the series, and I don't know how closely they'll adapt it. The first film was not a close adaptation to the first book. I mean, some of it was exactly the same, and some of it was wildly different, and that's their prerogative, but I'd be interested. They sent me the scripts for the first one before they started shooting it, so hopefully they'll do the same.
We're not asking for input, just sort of, here you go.
Yeah, so they asked for input very early on when Joe Russo wrote the first draft of the script.
Oh, nice.
I gave him a few days. I went out to L.A. and spent a few days with him. And then I stayed in contact with him, and they would send me, updated scripts, but it was never like, we want your feedback on it.
Yeah.
And because I would have been like, yeah, you keep calling him a CIA agent or somebody a CIA agent. They're actually an officer, an agent, someone who works on behalf of, but not for. And, little things like that. And they don't need that. It's almost like I would annoy me. If there was a me and I was writing something artistically and there was a version of me going like, I hate to ding you here, but blah, blah, blah. I get those emails from people all the time. So I don't know that if they don't have to have it, they don't get it.
Well, there's probably a different, the moviegoers want something where somebody who is a diehard fan of your book wants the detail and in the description to such great extent. But I guess when you're trying to fit a adaptation into an hour 30,
it's a completely different medium. And I could show you hundreds, if not 1,000 emails from fans that are mad at me personally. And they're like, next time you need to do this and this, and they'll come up to me and say, well, in the book this happened, and in the movie this happened. And I'm like, yeah, I saw the movie, I read the book, I know all this. It's like, what do you want me to do? And I always go like, I don't know why you're coming to me about this. The book is still the book. If it's on your shelf, go look at it. It has not changed.
Yes.
And that's what I wrote. So I'm super happy with the movie. I'll never say anything bad about it. It was great for me personally.
It was entertaining.
Yeah, and it was really entertaining. So I'm looking forward to the next one.
So are we. So are a lot of people. You're speaking of films. Did you happen to catch the Spielberg? I'm forgetting Tom Hanks, Masters of the
Earth. Yeah.
Have you finished it yet?
Yes. I do a monthly newsletter, and every month I do a recommendation for a book or a movie or whatever. And I was like, if you don't have Apple Plus, think about getting it because it was really good. In some ways, narratively, it wasn't as good as Band of Brothers, but it just felt like they nailed details. You just have to respect that in this day and age because it's so easy to CGI everything and to just skirt over details in reality for expediency or to save money. And those B-17s, you felt it was scary to be like a tail gunner in a B-17. I imagined it to be really scary. And then when you watch that, you're like, God, that's intense.
Just to see the line of hundreds of German planes coming at you, knowing that you're just a big fat target.
Yeah.
I as I watch it, I'm thinking, and I looked at my wife, I'm like, I would have chosen the ground
yeah,
any day of the week and, yeah, and twice on Sunday over being in the air.
Yeah. Wasn't it the most, like the most dangerous job in the Second World War was they lost like 20% or 25% yeah, or some crazy massive number. And, yeah, and it just seems like a terrible way to fight. You know, these daylight raids where you're just blanketing the sky. It's almost like, how does flak even miss?
Insane.
But, you know, I guess that's how they won the war. I don't know.
I found it. I had to get up and get out of the house after the last episode, which was this Friday, I think. Just watching them, the war ends and they just get in their plane. They fly back to the United States after being there for years. It was just, well, the ones that made it.
Yeah, the ones that survived.
Just the feeling they must have felt coming home after such a long journey.
Yeah, my dad was in the Second World War, and he was a infantry combat in Germany. And at VE Day, he got lucky. So he had been in California training for the invasion, the ultimate invasion of Japan, which they'd been planning for a long time. Then the Bulge, Battle of the Bulge, happened in the winter of 44, early 45, I guess it's all the winter of 44. And then they went and got everybody in California that was planning on going into Tokyo Bay and sent him over there. So he only was in 33 days of combat. In not only
33 is enough.
Yeah, 33 is more than I did.
About 1 minute is enough
sometimes. Yeah, and he was in Germany and, you know, crossed the Rhine, just south of Cologne and everything. And the war ended. He went back home. And then he was in the Philippines, in Manila Bay, still on the boat when the war ended with the atomic bombs. And so he didn't have to fight over there, but he was involved in, like, police action over there for 6 months or so. I think rounding up as many Japanese as they could in the Philippines. I think I don't know if you know these stories, but they found, like, Japanese in, like, 1972 or 74 or something.
Still in caves.
That didn't know the war was over. And that's, like, so fascinating to me that happened.
Brainwashed
completely.
I mean, with an ideology, and you could say the same about Americans.
Yeah,
we have an ideology as much as Al Qaeda or ISIS has an ideology. Yeah. But if I'm remembering this correctly, you know, we recently had Oppenheimer, which won all the, what was it, the Emmy? Was it, that was the Golden Globes?
Oscars.
I don't watch those shows. in the decision to drop that bomb, I think it was very easy to make the decision because I think the estimates of the amount of soldiers that were going to be lost was close to 1 million if they did a mainland invasion into Japan.
Yeah, and my dad, you know, I had this conversation with him and he was like, you know, at the time we all thought it was a pretty good idea. And they declassified the battle plans for the invasion of Japan, I want to say 94, 95. My dad immediately, you know, he was, you know, 21 at the time, but here it is in 1995. He immediately went to read everything that was declassified, and his division was in the first wave of army divisions going into Tokyo Bay, and no way he would have made it. My dad was 120 pounds soaking wet at the time.
Dude, the greatest generation.
Yeah, for sure.
By far. So AI, getting back to the book, how much research did you have to go into this? What sort of mediums did you use to get deep into AI?
So I knew nothing. I knew nothing other than, you know, I'm watching TV and I'm seeing, like, these tech bro billionaires saying we're going to put a chip in everybody's brain. It's going to be awesome. And I'm going like, hey, I think I've got a plot. I've got a plot idea that's come out of here. And also, when you do what I do for a living, your adversaries are Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. And then you recycle or do some version of that. So I'm always looking for other bad actors. And so I knew very little about AI other than, you know, it seemed like it could be something to write about. And so I went and basically I read about five books, only five books, but I read, I listened to hundreds of hours of podcasts on AI. And I did it from January of last year until September of last year. Every day working out, every day driving, every day taking my dogs to the park. So it was probably about 2 hours a day for whatever, 120 days. And then I just read think tank publications on the ethics of it all. And I read, you know, news reports and other documentation on the robotics that are all throughout the book and what's out there. And then I read things about, you know, government publications about, you know, China, U.S.'s DOD philosophy on never taking the human out of the loop of the kill chain, and China's competing philosophy, speed is the essence of war, and they're, you know, we're entering an arms race in speed militarily. And so I did all this research, and I'm writing the book at the same time. I would love to do the research first and then write the book, but it just I'm never able to do that. So I'm writing and researching, and I'll write something and learn that it's dumb later, and then go back and fix it in an edit. But I did as deep a dive as I could, and it was fascinating. And it's also something, it's one of those few things that I'm researching where I'm going like, this could all be different a year from now, because there's nothing advancing more quickly than this technology.
AI is now like the USSR space race. It's the space race between, or it's the AI race between the US and China.
Absolutely. It's like nuclear. I read somebody was talking about like the Gatling gun. And so I was interested in these private labs, these private AI labs, you know, like OpenAI and those sort of places, and how they fit in with the military. And it's all dual use, right? So everything that they're developing, they're like, well, it's for peaceful purposes. But, you know, when you look at the Gatling gun in the 1800s, Richard Gatling invented that to save lives, which sounds insane, but his philosophy was you could use a weapon where four people can do the work of 100, so then you'd only need to have four on the battlefield, and that's going to save so many lives. And you see how wrong that is.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that with AI. Without getting too deep into the ethics, unless you want to, I think there's just this feeling that, there's going to be a utopia. And then on the other side, there's a feeling there's going to be an Armageddon. I imagine it's somewhere in between, just like most things are.
It's like the Terminator.
Yeah.
All over again.
Yeah.
And we don't know what we don't know at this point, which is going to be interesting.
Right.
I just read that the U.S. Air Force has a jet, AI-powered, AI-driven, where they said they've defaulted it to where it can't refuse orders. Mm. Like there's a fail safe to say, no, you will do this. If they input, you will go bomb this, you will go bomb this. That's pretty interesting if there is a fail safe. But again, yeah. AI's ability to learn and override is what scares.
Yeah, the scary part is these deep neural networks that are able to rewrite their own code and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And, they say if something can't be anticipated, it can't be tested. So AI, a very famous thing, I want to say it was like 2018 or 2019, where they had one of the best Air Force F-16 pilots in a simulator fighting an AI jet in the simulator. It was 15-0. The human never got a shot off, lost all 15 times, and had no concept that of this thing called a front quarter shot, where it's like a head on, you know, shooting a missile up your nose, because that's not how humans fight, at Mach 0.8 or whatever they're fighting at. You don't go head to head with these guys. And they just said, you know, the artificial intelligence doesn't care about getting home to the wife and kids, doesn't care about G-forces, and it's just completely demolished the human. And so a lot of people who say AI is not that sophisticated, I just did a book tour with over 100 interviews, and probably 8 or 9 times, you know, some DJ in some town is kind of snarky, and they're kind of like, yeah, I tried to get AI to write a song about, you know, my girlfriend, and it was ridiculous, so I'm not too worried about it taking over the world. And I just kind of roll my eyes and I go like, yeah, it can create human level scores on the SAT and the bar exam. And, you know, it can defeat, an Air Force pilot in dogfighting. And it's in its infancy. You know, where's it going to be in a year? And the amazing, most amazing thing that I learned through all this is the computing hardware that is going into building artificial intelligence has increased 10 billion% since 2010. It's doubling every 6 months. And the data being hoovered in by this to teach the AI that makes it grow, and it's like it's fuel, data is fuel, is doubling about every 2 years. So it's big and getting bigger.
And we're in a war for chips. That's why Taiwan is, but now we're actually building, we're investing in infrastructure to build more facilities here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the good news in all this is that China makes 0% of these high-level GPUs, graphic processing unit chips, that are necessary for the most advanced AI. So,
but they're probably starting.
I mean, I'm sure they're trying.
Yeah.
There's three countries in the world where they make the chip making technology, the Netherlands, US, and Japan. And so to make the high level chips, you need technology out of those three places. And I'm sure Chinese intelligence is doing everything they can to get that stuff. And the chips themselves are made in Taiwan, as you said, 90% are made in Taiwan. And the rest, I think, are made in Korea. And, you know, Taiwan is 100 miles off the coast of China. And China didn't need any more reasons to go after Taiwan. They, you know, they had their all their sort of like sociological reasons they want Taiwan. And there's other reasons, you know, fishing rights, all these other things. And now there's this on top of it. You're just like, what a powder keg.
It's, and we are so distracted in so many regions mm-hmm. of the world. And I mean, hell, as we're doing this, you've got the Afghanistan withdrawal hearings going on.
Yeah.
Just right today. Now.
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting. Yeah. What about drones? I mean, you've used drones. Uh-huh. And it seems like I see it's easier to send 1,000 drones with a grenade, mm-hmm. you know, across a horizon with ground troops. I just see drones and everyone is, I get calls every week. Hey, can you advise on this drone? I'm like, I'm too old. You know, my time, there's better soft guys to answer those questions. But it seems like drones have just been, they've been the weapon of choice, not only in the Middle East with attacks on our bases, but within the Ukraine and Russia. You see those videos coming out just nonstop.
Yeah, so what's really interesting about the drone warfare going on in Ukraine is Ukraine loses 10,000 drones a month, which is sounds like a lot. But they're $400 Chinese drones. That's $4 million. An F-16 is $63 million.
Yes. Cost now, effective.
Yeah. The military has a term, attritable, which is you're able to lose a number of them without it, you know, so there's no humans involved, and which I'm sure you as a human former military, you're like, I felt attritable at different times in my career.
Many times.
I'm sure you were, unfortunately. But yeah, so 10,000 drones lost a month is a price, you know, $4 million is not much. It's really one of the most effective weapons that they have over there right now. And the different types of robotics that I use in my book, there's nothing in my book that's science fiction. It's all existing technology or emerging technology. And the drones, at least that I use, quadcopters and hexacopters, there's at least prototype versions of them that will carry a payload, and the payload is a quadruped, like a robot dog that has a 6.5 Creedmoor on its back, drop it off on the roof of a building, fly away, and you know, stand off while it fights, and then go and pick it up and fly away. That we're there. That's not what they're using in Ukraine, because they don't need to use it, and they want it to be attritable. And they're using $400 drones from China, and they're you know, God bless them for doing it. It's pretty. Have you seen, you know, the videos of like Russians surrendering to drones, you know, and the drone, you know, like leads them back, you know, and you go, wow, where's warfare going to be in 10 years, you know, 20 years?
It's insane. And, you know, one, you mentioned the 6.5 Creedmoor. Let me say this. I do remember the command I was at. Our charter was research, development, testing, and evaluation. Mm-hmm. The guys purchased, which is very easy for us to do commercial off the shelf, DJIs. And they were flying them in front of our mobility patrols.
Yeah.
It just, the technology wasn't there yet because it didn't have any form of night vision, which we're going to operate at night. We're not going to operate during the day.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was useful for a lot of things just to take a quick glance over a hill to see if that's the direction we wanted to go or somewhere else. So it had uses, and the guys that ordered them were always ahead of the times. Like they were just, they were always forward thinking.
Yeah.
It just, 2014, it just wasn't there yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, obviously they do have night vision now, and they have AI on board. A lot of the things that they're using, it's not an autonomous weapon, but image classifiers. So, you know, it's able to like go out and look for a tank or a Jeep or whatever, and, you know, kind of lock in on that. You know, it can sort of search for a target, discriminate against possible targets, identify the target. Where it's weaponized is, you know, the OODA loop, obviously, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. Probably everybody that watches your show does, but it's observe, orient, decide, and act. It's a paradigm of combat. The D, the decide, the minute we turn the keys over to artificial intelligence to make that decision to engage a target, that's when you've got a lethal autonomous weapon.
And for the viewers, listeners, the OODA loop, it was developed by Major John Boyd, who was an Air Force fighter pilot. Yeah. Basically, it's the decision-making process in order to evaluate information quickly and then take or act, decide
yeah.
and act.
Yeah.
I've even seen interesting use of using drones as repeaters for line of sight, which is...
Yeah. Yeah. There's drones that will charge other drones now. So almost like...
In the air?
Yeah. Almost like a tanker, you know, can charge a thing. And they don't actually have to land on it. They just sort of like fly over it. It's like charging your iPhone or something. So, you know, you're going to have these standoff things that... You know, there's been the ability to have missiles for since I think the 60s or 70s that can identify a ship and attack it. Mm-hmm. And so you fire off over the horizon, go find a ship and attack it. But they were never really used that much because why are you launching missiles if you don't know that you have it where your target is?
Because then it hits a civilian.
Yeah. Or drops in the water and you've wasted all this money. Well, with drones, it's very different. It can go loiter somewhere. It has its little image classifier in its brain. It's like, if I see this, I'm going to kill it.
Armor ID.
Yeah. And then if it doesn't see it, it comes back or potentially, you know, recharges with some device and just hangs out there. So it's pretty horrifying.
What I've not researched or done any looking into is anti-drone mm-hmm. warfare.
Yeah.
I saw at one point they were trying to train like hawks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to intercept, grab them, and just...
A hawk would screw up a lot of those drones.
It's almost like the Navy Dolphin program.
Right,
if
sure.
If you ever remember that.
I do remember that, yeah.
Which I think was, like, mildly successful. Some dolphins would just take off and never be seen again, yeah. Which you AWOL. Understand. Yeah. But how that opens up that whole industry.
Yeah,
so... And jamming.
Yeah, so there's jamming. There's a lot of technology I think the Russians are working on to target... the signal of the user. So there, you know, there's a guy in a trench who's flying that drone that's dropping the grenade inside the, you know, the port of the tank or whatever. There's ways that you can sort of identify where that signal's come and then just target it. And so that's a thing. There's these nets that have been developed that can be fired out of guns or whatever. I don't know how practical that stuff is. I mean, it looks cool, but I don't know how practical it is. My buddy who is the Marine Lieutenant Colonel, who I wrote that book with in 2009, and I was talking about, you know, a drone, you know, like, what if a drone does this and that? And he's just like, oh, we just shoot it. He's like, I just would have a 60 guys open up on it and then shoot it down, you know? And so it's like... All right, that's a technology as well. And in my book, there's a big scene where a swarm, kind of a hive of drones all working together, all taking information off of each other and acting at machine speed is coming at a group of special operations personnel. And they've got light machine guns. And that's the battle that they find themselves in.
Yeah, that's a predicament.
Yeah.
I did read quite a bit on the Hive network. Basically a hive of drones that could take airplanes out of the sky.
Yeah.
You hive it and just you force it out of the sky, which,
yeah,
again, is cost effective. When you're taking a multi-million dollar aircraft, if it's a Gen 5 plane out of the sky.
Yeah, and it's not just big nations that have access to this. You can rent neural networks online, you know, in the cloud, and we're going to see terrorists with individual drones and terrorists with swarms of drones. And we're going to see a lot of, you know, the threat vectors of this are going to come at us from different directions.
So back to the 6.5 Creedmoor, you're still shooting a lot or as much as you can.
Yeah. I'm shooting tomorrow. I can't wait.
Are you?
Yeah.
You're in Austin?
No, I'm going home to Memphis, but okay. I just got a staccato. And
Factory's here.
Yeah, yeah.
I just got an email from one of the guys that runs it. They're having a show on Sunday. I said, I'll stop by, man.
Oh, you should go by. Have you shot one?
No, I haven't. I've heard they're beautiful pistols.
Oh, it's amazing. One of my best friends has one, and I liked it so much, I put it in a book. And so that I've met the staccato guys last year at SHOT Show, and it's special. Now, it has a special price, so it's the market for it is whatever the market for it is, but golly, it's an incredible piece of machinery.
So I'm not surprised you're at the SHOT Show. That must be, do you set up a booth or do you walk around?
No, last year Aimpoint asked me to come and they bought hundreds of my books and I just signed them for people. And it is so much fun. And my wife came with me and she has no attachment to gun culture or anything. She's definitely not anti. I mean, we've gone out to like a farm and shot and stuff like that. But it was kind of funny to have her in the middle of all that. 'Cause I'm like, whatever you're expecting I'm the guy without the beard. You'll be able to find me. I'm the guy without the beard at SHOT Show. And there's, tens of thousands of people there.
The SHOT Show, I actually call it the shit show.
Yeah.
Because it is absolute shit show.
It is wild. So Aimpoint had me there and, it was so much fun. And I was literally like signing a book for somebody and he's like, I'm John Farnham. And I'm like, oh my God, you're the famous instructor, John Farnham. It's like, how cool is that? You know, I'm just meeting these people randomly. The guy who, I can't remember his name now, is the head of Walther. Yes. I had drinks with him. I'm like, how cool is this? You know, I have a little Walther, old Walther P99. It's really cool. But I didn't get to go to SHOT Show this year because I was late on a book. I was working all through the holidays and Christmas and New Year's. And Aimpoint asked me to come back out and do it again. And I was like, for the rest of my life, every January, I would love to do that with you guys. But this is a year where I got way too far behind writing two books, and I couldn't go this year.
Yeah, it is. I mean, hunting crowd, you get the military crowd. I mean, you're seeing the advanced technology that's coming out from a ground perspective.
Yeah, the first real quadruped, four-legged robot I saw there. I guess it was like Ghost, Boston Dynamics or somebody had one there. And that gave me a lot of ideas, you know, just to experience that in person.
It's good to see that they're finally, the military has gotten wise. They're now designing rifles around the better round versus, hey, this round's really cheap, this 5.56, which stayed in the inventory for way too long. Vietnam to, I mean, even I think they're still transitioning them out.
So what's the new caliber? I really don't know this.
So I think the 6.5 Creedmoor, they played with it. Was it the 6.8 Grendel?
Yeah.
I remember the Marine Corps. Mm. I think this is after MARSOC was formed. Started playing around with the 408 Chi-Tech.
Oh, wow.
Which I heard was just shoots like a laser.
Powerful cartridge, right?
Powerful. They had like a carbonized version and a longer version. But I think cost-wise, it was just too expensive. Mm. Somebody said it was like $7 a round or something.
Oh boy.
And so they couldn't justify it.
Yeah.
But you can when a soldier costs what? $450,000 with their, SGLI.
Exactly.
Like you can afford the.
And that $7 a round, once the military gets a hold of it, it's going to be like $26.50 a round or something.
That's true. Good for the commercial market. You're working on the next book, which is it anticipated for the same time next year, February 25?
Yep. Book 14 in the series will be out next February. And so, the day after this book comes out, I get 100 emails from people going like, write faster. And I'm like, come on, man. I'm cranking out a lot of words. Chaos Agent's a big book. Like, I like to give people value for their money. And I think really what it is my first book is all action, The Gray Man.
Yes.
First novel. It's just action after action after action. And I want to have that much action in every book, but I want there to be other things. So Chaos Agent's 170,000 words, almost 600 pages, and it's not my longest book. So I write big books. So I'm already working on book 14 in the series. I was working on it right before I came in here. And I have a different book coming out in June.
Can you give any insight into that, or is it closed?
Well, the book that's coming out in June, I can talk about all day, it's called Sentinel. It's the second book in my Josh Duffy series. The first one was called Armored, and it's about this guy who's a former civilian military contractor, now working as a mall cop, who gets a chance to go back into the high threat industry, but it's in the Sierra Madres and the cartels, and it's a disaster. So now it's 3 years later, and he's working for State Department Diplomatic Security. And his wife is a Foreign Service officer with the State Department. So they get sent to Ghana, Africa, which is the most stable nation in the African coup belt. It's surrounded by nations that have had coups. So I went in last November, I went to Ghana and spent a week with the diplomatic security guys at the embassy. And, you know, the Marines there, and learned all about it, and, you know, hung out with the ambassador, and it was just an incredible experience. And I got out into the countryside for like location research and stuff. So it was great. Those guys, the DS guys, work really, really hard.
Oh, yeah, they do.
A lot of times I do things and people are really happy to see me there. And it's like, oh, yeah, flying our plane and we're going to do this stuff. These guys were at work and I was just kind of like in their way. I mean, they were super awesome and they went out of their way for me. But at the same time, I was going like, you know, there's a lot going on here and it's not some idiot writing a book. But yeah, so I wrote that book and it'll be out in June. It's called Sentinel. And book 14 in the Gray Man series can take place in Central Europe. And I'm going to go do some research there later this spring. And I'm excited to do that.
That trip sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be it's going to be one of those things. There's like four locations I want to go and I'll have a limited amount of time. So it's going to be getting on my wife just yesterday is like, I'm not going to fly on a 737 MAX. She goes with me on some of my research trips. So, you know, the Boeing 737 MAX has had the trouble and Boeing in general is. And I'm like, okay, that means there's a lot of places you won't be able to go because I don't necessarily know what plane I'm getting on. if I'm flying Latvian Air.
I have no control over that.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly. And I get why she says that, you know, that's you know, it's her right. But at the same time, I'm like, I got to get on the plane and hope that, you know, the statistical probability that's in play is going to work in my favor.
She's safer getting on a 737 MAX than she is in the car statistically.
Yeah, can I pull my phone out and you can call her and tell her that? Because
she's like, who are you? What are your credentials? I have none. So it's worth nothing. I've got to ask. Court Gentry is not an answer. It's off the table.
Okay.
Beyond him, what character has been your favorite character, whether you've written about it or you know, Tom Clancy or any of the other, who's the character you sort of connect with the most from another writer that you really like their work?
God, that's such a tough question. There's a guy named Greg Hurwitz and his Orphan X series. I really like his character, Evan Smoke, who is sort of a Asperger-y assassin, but very well done. Not like a cliche or anything like that. He's a contemporary. I mean, Jack Ryan, you know, going way back. One of the Clancy books I did, the last one I did with Tom before he passed away, was called Command Authority. And we did it in two timelines. So it was a present day timeline and another one that was 30 years before. So I actually got to write Jack Ryan in the mid 80s, which is like when I've discovered these books and when these books changed my life. And so I have him in East Berlin and all this stuff going on. And I just remember going like, I'm so connected to what I'm doing right now, like so uniquely connected to it because I grew up on this stuff.
You know, I'd have to say Jack Ryan. And again, with the, I think it was Amazon had the series, right?
Yeah.
They did such a great job. Mm-hmm. And what's the actor's name? He was from The Office.
John Krasinski.
Yeah. Did a great job. Yeah. What I love about these characters is it shows the depth of effective intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you wouldn't stay alive if you weren't wildly intelligent, yeah, but it just breaks the narrative of just a dumb, you know, assassin or killer. And that's what you love. And that they're complex characters. I mean, they show empathy.
Yeah.
They show humor beneath that sort of stone cold.
Yeah. And that's what I like. I like the vulnerability as well as the strengths. And I like dynamic writing. I like light and dark and I like funny stuff coming up when you wouldn't think it would. I think that when I started going to firearm schools and like I'd be around military people really for the first time, I didn't serve, and law enforcement people, and you hear the gallows humor of these guys and you're like, wow, that's what keeps you going. You know, I guess when times are really, really tough. And I remember being so fascinated by that. I was at a firearm school once and there was another civilian there and we're like the only two. Everybody else was active duty, this or that. And, you know, I was listening to the guys. We were in the team room one night and I just kind of looked at the other guy and I was like, I'm just here for the laughs. He's like, yeah, me too. I was like, it's so interesting, you know, how you guys,
hysterical,
how you guys are able to, I don't know, flip that switch and the humor that is in the most awful situations.
Humor is a thing of power. Mm-hmm. And dude, I remember, you know, it was a bad moment. We were getting hit pretty hard and somebody stood up with their saw to shoot back. And you just heard the clank of the bolt drive home and no round went off. Mm. And somebody goes, wah, 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 wah. And everyone just laughed their ass off. And it was almost a moment like, hey, are we good here?
Yeah,
we're good here. And got right back in the fight. Oh, but these guys are, when you surround yourself with these guys, it is nonstop hysterics. Sometimes to the point where you're just like, okay, I need to be alone.
Right.
But you can only get away with it in that environment. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I miss.
Yeah.
I go do that, like, at a job, and somebody's like, HR! Yeah. He just, like, yeah, like you're so scared you can't say anything to these people.
Yeah. I've heard things that I certainly won't repeat on this family show. But, like, you know, you just, like, walk away from that and go, like, I can't believe that, you know, that just happened. But it's cool. You know, it's really cool because it shows how dynamic it is. And I've read some people's books, you know, that are, you know, writing the tough guy, you know, mission. He's on some mission and he's complete badass 24/7. Nothing bad ever happens to him. Never really does anything clever. Always just sort of, you know, goes from winning to winning to winning to winning to winning to the end. And that's just not interesting to me. And that's not how life is. And that's not how these people are that, you know, who I've met, who are as close to the characters in my book.
I've always said it. I'll say it again. The most lethal warriors I served with were kind. They were respectful. They were empathetic. They were vulnerable. And sometimes the highest performing amongst them were your biggest liability. Mm. Like, I mean, they're great on the battlefield. You bring them back. You put them into society. Yeah. Like, hey, so-and-so just knocked somebody out of the bar. You're like, oh, great. Now I've got to report that up. And like, how are we going to handle this?
So I was a ghostwriter for two books for a guy who was in a special mission unit. And real guy, you know, amazing dude, but wasn't necessarily a writer, but we had ideas. And so I, early in my career, and so I took the lead. I had never been in his special mission unit, nor any special mission unit. And I always made the joke on the range. I'm like, the reason I didn't make it in Delta is because I always forget one of my elbow pads. Everybody else has got theirs. And other ones, you know, that's somewhere down in my car and I can't find it. But I wrote like the first 50 pages of this, you know, after we had this conversation, and I sent it to him. And of course, I'm like nobody. It was very early in my career. I had a couple paperback books. Nobody knew who I was. I wasn't in the military. You know, I sold medical devices internationally for a living. And then he came back to me, and this guy was, I think he retired as a colonel and was Army. And he's like, oh man, it's really good. You know, I'm really impressed with what you do. He's like, can I ask a favor though? And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And he's like, could we maybe dial back the cussing a little bit? He's like, I got a couple young daughters, and I had never felt smaller in my entire life. You know, it's like I'm trying to pretend like I'm this guy to write this book, and I don't know this guy. And then when I get to know them, I was like, oh my gosh, it's not the way that I, you know, I had him a little Dick Marchenko type, and and he was a lot more of a you know, philosopher.
There are the Dick Marchenko types. Yeah. God rest his soul. Yeah. I mean, innovator. Mm-hmm. Much like Charlie Beckwith.
Yeah.
We were at a Special Operations Warrior Foundation gala in Florida, of course, Tampa, where they're located. And I brought my wife out, and there was a pre-event the night before for ambassadors, and it's a bunch of, you know, generals and admirals. And my wife looks at me, and she's like, these aren't your people, are they? I'm like, no. I'm like the lowest guy, the lowest ranking man in the room. I don't know anyone. They're all having high-level conversations. And then this little guy comes up. I mean, probably 5'4", and the nicest guy in the world. And I end up talking. He says his name is Sean. And I'm talking to him, and he's sweet to my wife, and we're talking. He's like, hey, and I'm like, Sean, I didn't catch your last name. He's like, and I won't repeat it. And he's like, hey, guys, let me, I got to go say hello to somebody. I'll be right back. And I look at my wife and I'm like, I know who that guy is. And he is a freaking badass.
Oh, yeah.
Like the stories that this guy has.
Yeah.
He was at a special mission unit.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, that guy? I'm like, don't judge a book by its cover. I'm like, the most lethal guys I ever knew were small in stature.
Absolutely.
And I mean, she was, and she's like, he's so nice. I'm like, yeah, that's just, but they have that switch. They flip from, you know, just a normal conversation to zero empathy to get the mission
done.
Doing
what you have to do.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And when I meet people, I've never kind of prejudge because I've run into that enough. A good buddy of mine, Brad Taylor, who's a really good author, former, Delta guy. And, you know, my wife, who again has no connection with any of that sort of stuff, she loves Brad and his wife Elaine. And she just doesn't get that he used to be in a special mission unit and you know, in the war on terror for a long time and all that. It's like, that just does not compute with her. She's so fascinated by that.
That it's that warms my heart to hear that. Because that, I mean, when guys act like that, you'll never even know.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Why I like the guy so much. As we wrap up, you probably get this question all the time. 13 books in the series now. If someone has never read one of the volumes of the Gray Man series, do you tell them to start at the beginning or does it, you're like, hey, start wherever you want?
You can absolutely start wherever you want. That's so important to me as a reader because I've been a reader longer than I've been a writer. I've been a failed writer longer than I've been a successful writer. So, you know, I hate it when I pick up a book and it's mid-series and they basically just make hints about stuff that's happened before. And, you know, the opening part of it is an after action report of the last book. And I'm like, I don't want this. And it's like, so every one of my books, you can just jump right in and it sets the stage and you go from there. If you read them in order, there's a longer story arc because you want to reward the people that do it that way as well. But if you read book 8 and then book 13 and then go back and read book 1, it's not going to be weird or jarring. It's hopefully will be interesting because like this character has developed over time. In my book Sierra 6, which was a couple back, it goes back in time and shows him working in the Special Activities Division group. So when I first wrote my hero, Court Gentry, I knew nothing about anything. And so I had him in SAD, and he's a CIA paramilitary and basically a ninja or whatever. And it's funny now because I know SAD guys, and they're like, yeah, we've all had like 4 VA surgeries.
Yeah, you know, exactly. It's like I know quite a few as well. They're old, they're broke, but they still keep on going.
And I'm like, hey, that's how I built the story. I'm going to stick with it.
We have a good friend. He's here in Austin. He was a SEAL. Then the Navy sent him back to become a doctor, and he became the doctor to the SEAL teams.
Oh, wow.
Just when it comes to high performance, the guy is – but he did the math, and it was something like a SEAL who serves 20 years has had an average of 8 surgeries across the course of those 20 years. I'm like, I lucked out.
Yeah.
I had 2, one when I was wounded and one on my hip. But it's not a forgiving –
no,
profession.
It's not. My buddy Josh Hood, who's a really good author, he posted something the other day because he was 82nd Airborne, and he's like, "Yeah, I just got back from the VA, and they said my back problem's not service related." And he posted a picture of him with all his jump gear, you know, the big thing between his legs or whatever. He's like, "Yeah, no, it's nothing to do with my back problems now."
God bless. Well, I know they took the jump mission away from the 101st. But God bless those guys in the 82nd and the 101st that used to jump all the time.
Yeah.
Static line jumping,
yeah,
round parachutes. You had to, so to get to military free fall, you've got to do your 5 jumps at Fort Campbell, mm-hmm. I believe it is.
Okay.
Awful. I would start shaking.
Scarier than free fall? Or just comes first?
Free fall is great. If you are decent with the parachute, it's a soft landing. No, the very first jump, I hit like a bag of rocks.
Ugh.
And then for my next 4, I would start shaking before I hit the ground and get the knees all, like, please God, don't let me get hurt. Please God, don't let me get hurt.
Yeah.
And literally one of our young SEAL officers, I was at the time as well, hits the ground, is knocked out, and you see him getting dragged across the entire drop zone. Yeah. Of course, he had to go home and then come back for 2 more jumps.
So you have very little control over where you land with the round parachute.
They say you can pull a slip, and I say bullshit. Like it was, so I remember we did come back and do a six jump in SEAL qualification training, SQT. Mm. And it's at a place called Brownfield, which has this like sort of repoed car lot. Mm-hmm. And you're at the mercy of what we call the jump master, where he spots you and pushes you out. Yeah. Well, I end up right between two cars in the repo lot. And so I collect up my parachute, put it in the parabag, go running, you know, it was something like 1,000 meters, mm-hmm. to where the rally point was. And I start getting yelled at by the instructors and I wanted to say something back. And it's just like, yeah, it's no good.
Why were they yelling at you? But where you landed?
They're like, why didn't you pull a slip? And so I was like, are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, you don't think I was trying to pull a slip to avoid the fence and all the cars?
Yeah.
You
landed well considering where.
Yeah. When you transition to free fall, it is, it's like a blessing. it can be fun, except night combat jumps. Mm. Awful. You feel like the Michelin, the Stay Puff, Marshmallow Man.
You're just so exposed.
Your mobility's hard. We used to have the ripcord right here on your chest. Now they have it at the bottom of the container. And so as you're falling, it's time to pull. You got to like do this sort of contorted motion, which then makes you unstable. And it was in a night vision and it's the weapon. I did hit hard on one night combat jump. We were training for something really cool, actually. And I bent the weapon. Oh, I hit so hard.
Golly. Yeah. Better the weapon.
Than yeah. You. Oh, I walked away. I was fine. Yeah. All right. Well, dude, Mark, thank you for coming back. Congrats on the Chaos Agent. Guys, go pick it up. You can go to markgreeny.com, which has all his books. Or is Amazon the most common place?
Yeah, it's markgreenybooks.com. And Amazon works, any bookstore, on Audible, on the audiobooks as well.
Do you do the audio on your books?
No. I have a professional to do it.
That would be weeks. No.
Yeah, and he just does it better. The guy who does it, Jay Snyder, is fantastic.
Yeah. I know a lot of authors do that. You heard that. Pick up the hardback or the hardback. The audio is great, but... The books are well done. I'm only three deep, and thank you for sending me that one. But Mark, congrats on all the success in the Chaos Agent and the Burner before that, and we look forward to the next two within this year.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Yeah. All right, guys. That's been another episode of the Men's Journal Everyday Warrior Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. We'll see you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.